Welcome to the Blue Sky Podcast,
brought to you by Cambridge University Science Magazine.
I'm Ruby.
And I'm Simone.
Every 2 weeks, we speak to local researchers, university staff and students, and anyone who works in science to learn about their research and activities, hear about the work that they do, and uncover what goes on behind the scenes.
If you want to get in touch with a question, suggestion, or just want to be featured on the podcast, just drop us a tweet. Our handle is at BlueSciPod.
And you can also email us at bluescipodcast@gmail.com.
The Blue Sky Podcast is sponsored by Griner Bio One, who supply laboratory, diagnostic, and medical products to research institutions, higher education, the NHS, and others across the UK. For details of their full product range, visit www.gbo.com.
The Blue Sky Podcast is sponsored by Nature Careers. If you get a chance, take a look at Nature Careers' new funding website, which collates thousands of international funding and grant opportunities. So whether you're looking for an undergrad or postgrad scholarship, fellowships, or funding for a project, try a search at naturecareersfunding.com.
Welcome back to the podcast and Happy New Year from us at Blue Sky. It's actually really exciting for us that a new year is starting, because Ruby and I started hosting this podcast in January last year. So it's been a whole 12 months, where, you know, the whole world has changed, but we've been making episodes nonetheless. It's been great to learn all about such different aspects of science and different ways of doing science, initiatives to uplift people in science, and it's been quite the journey. We went from people who had no experience making podcasts to, you know, now spending a year doing so. So it's been really great. And we wanted to thank you all for being our listeners, for being here with us on this adventure. And we hope to keep bringing you more episodes and more great content this upcoming year. And we also wanted to say that if you have been enjoying the podcast and would like to get involved in some way, if you're a student at the university, do get in touch. It doesn't matter how much experience you have. We obviously had no experience when we started, and we're always looking to expand our team and get more people on board. Our guest this week is Constanza Toro Valdivieso, who's a PhD student in the Department of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Cambridge. And this episode's really special to us because we've really been admirers of Constanza's work for a while, and so we're really excited to have her on the episode. So her PhD looks at studying fur seals in Chile, and she actually looks at how the gut microbiome of these seals could give us insights about wildlife health and a way to non-invasively monitor changes in habitat, food networks, genetic diversity, and other factors that are important for wildlife conservation.
Would you like to start us off by explaining what your PhD is in and what you do?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. So my PhD is focused on using the microbiome to monitor wild populations. I'm particularly interested on using marine mammals as bioindicator of the environment. So the idea is to characterize the microbiome of this very particular pinniped species that only lives in these particular location in the Pacific, and see whether we can use particular patterns within the microbiome to, you know, monitor and see whether there might be some disruptions or dysbiosis. So that's kind of the main idea, but then it started growing up through other collaborations that were unexpected.
You say pinnipeds, is that sort of a seal species?
So pinnipeds are a group of marine mammals that are either seals or sea lions or even walruses. So you have like three kind of, I don't know how's the taxonomic classification at the moment because they keep changing, but I would say like three different families. So one is the true seals, that is like hooded seals or harbor seals, and the other ones are the sea lions, which are fur seals and other sea lion species. And then the walruses are separated in a different kind of cluster for themselves.
And why is it that those animals specifically are the ones that you're looking at as like indicators for that, the health of that wildlife?
Yeah, so I think I would love to give like a more like scientific explanation, but it's everything much more circumstantial. So I was doing I finished my vet degree in Chile, and I always wanted to work with wild species. And I knew about this place called Juan Fernandez Archipelago, which is it's like an archipelago that consists in three different islands. And there's this pinniped species that only inhabit that kind of region. And that's the only native marine mammal in the area. All the other mammals are kind of invasive or brought by humans. And I think pinnipeds are really cool too, because then they are a link, because they have to reproduce in land. They are a very, very good link between coastal environments and kind of more oceanic environments. So these seals have only been included in studies that, you know, the information was gathered, let's say, up to 2000. And since then, nothing has been done. So the reason why I ended up there is I was very interested on looking at canine distemper virus and other dog-related viruses, because then dogs and cats are sometimes roaming freely in the island. And I was worried about that kind of closeness between those species and the first ones, because it has been described in other pinnipeds where they have caught diseases from the dogs and other domestic animals. And that was the initial idea. And then I came to Cambridge and everything kind of got a bit deeper and more like generalized into the microbiome and other aspects. But that's how it started.
Oh, wow. It sounds amazing that you work on such a sort of isolated species. And so you use the microbiome as a sort of indicator of what might be going on. So for our less biologically trained listeners, could you just give us a quick overview of what we mean by microbiome and maybe the type of samples you collect from the seals?
Yeah. So the microbiome is the combination of microbes that live in either different levels of symbiosis with a host. Let's say that, like, now there's like lots of people that might have heard the gut microbiome. So the gut microbiome is the composition of microbes, virus, bacteria, archaea that lives within the gut that perform particular functions that allow us to be who we are. So they are involved in sugar breaking and proteolysis in some aspects and so on. They are also very, very, it seems that they are very deeply communicated with other systems, such as the nervous systems and stuff like that. So the microbiome is practically kind of an extra organ that we have. And even like most of our genes come from that microbiome. So I work particularly with feces. So when you picture myself like working with seals, it's not that glamorous. I just go walking the shoreline, collect these feces. And the reason why I collect these feces is because they can be an image of the colonic, so the microbes that inhabit the colon. And the colon is the part of the system that contains the more variety and most numbers of microbiome or microbes. So the idea is to use the feces, which are non-invasive, which is also very important for me, because then the idea is to like be the less invasive possible. So then you diminish any bad situation.
So in terms of we've heard about kind of how you do your work, but what have you found out so far about, you know, you were going in to study this isolated species that no one had looked at for ages. Well, what do we know now about them?
Yeah, that's really cool. So then the thing is that the ultimate aim is to use the microbiome, but obviously before using the microbiome, you need to know what's there and what's normal. So there has been like various studies that are using the have looked into the microbiome of other pinnipeds and other marine mammals. So we know more or less what to expect. So far, the microbiome is consistent with the So you have the core microbiome, which is like the main groups that will be there more constantly across the individuals or even across different species within that same family, right? So we were very interested because then we found a very interesting pattern that we cannot really, we haven't understand the meaning of that pattern that is very different to the main cluster of the samples that I have. So we have a cluster of samples that seem to have a very similar microbiome, which I think would be the main kind of core microbiome. And then we have another group which have a cluster slightly further, and they have a different pattern. The problem with working with marine mammal microbiomes is that the information, the literature that is there available, it's still very not solid. So it's very hard to extrapolate information from other studies to, you know, new studies generated. That's because the techniques have been changed quite a lot, and the studies are very kind of widely distributed through time. So the methods have changed, and then therefore the outputs of those informations have changed. So we would really like to see what that pattern means, and then that patterns could be because, for example, they have different diets. So, for example, literature have shown that there's a gender difference in prey between males and females from pinnipeds, and they even like the diving depth will change. So diet is a very huge influence on microbial on bacterial microbiome. So that could be a difference, or it could be that it's a different age. For example, young fur seals. I would say seals, but I'm talking about sea lions. Young seals are in this stage where they are going from milk based diet to including like more protein, so fish and squid and other things. So they might have a different microbiome as well. Other things could be, for example, health disruptors, but because we don't know what could be considering as a healthy microbiome, we can still not say, oh yeah, you know, that difference because they're all ill. Moving a bit away from the microbiome, we have been very lucky and have developed very interesting collaborations. And then we were able to have a collaboration with Jonathan Powell, and we were looking at heavy metals.
Yeah.
And that was very interesting because we, with another collaboration from the British Antarctic Survey, we got some fecal samples from Antarctica, and we were able to compare more or less the exposure to microbiome. Obviously, this is only in feces, which means that they are not absorbing all of these things, but we know that they are quite exposed. So we found that there are like lots of toxic heavy metals, or what it looks like very toxic heavy metals, in the feces from Juan Fernandez versus the Antarctic. And for example, cadmium could be one of those that are like quite present in the Juan Fernandez fur seal. Now the Juan Fernandez fur seal feeds very close to the plastic gyre. So the plastic gyre, oh well, not the plastic, the ocean gyre in the South Pacific. And this is a place where you have this current, I don't know how you call this, centrifuge?
Like a whirlpool?
Yes.
Yeah, like a whirlpool. Yeah.
Yes. So then, because of the currents, all the debris will kind of combine in this area. And we're talking about a place that is as big as, well, according to someone, it's quite big. I think someone described it as like India, like the size of India. Like it's a huge place of like most concentrated plastic debris. This is based on an expedition that was done by this crazy scientist from the States. His name is, he called himself Captain Charles Moore, and he's great. We have been collaborating, and that's how I ended up in all this like toxic stuff, because we met in the island very randomly. And he was like measuring the concentration of plastics through the Pacific. So he started from California, well, all the way to the South Pacific. And then he determined the size of this space. So perhaps this kind of, more exposure or higher exposure to these contaminated areas could perhaps explain these like more access to, you know, metals. We are still like very early stages, so we don't know still what this means. So I want to be very careful not to say like, oh no, they are all dying, because we don't know. So it's, I think that's a very interesting thing. And then we had another collaboration with Germany, with a university in Germany, and then they were looking at parasites. And David found cases of Cryptosporidium and Giardia, which are zoonotic. Those brings up another kind of layer, because then when you work with marine mammals or like with anything that is wild, it's not that you're looking at a box, but everything is interrelated. So then that comes into another layer that has to do with public health as well. You know, so then it's like, yeah, lots of like different things that we have been finding that we were not expecting.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating. It's kind of like been a Pandora's box, really. And it's really interesting that, you know, you found these differences in the microbiota, and although you can't be 100% sure what could be causing it, you know, there's all of these factors, you know, like plastic, yeah, heavy metals, age, sex, diet. It's just so interesting. And it sounds like, because it is quite, you know, a remote species, you're kind of laying the groundwork for a lot of future studies for these types of animals. So what are your hopes for the future with this research, you know, to sort of build a body of work around it? Do you think there'll be more and more people getting involved, or what are your hopes for it?
Yeah, so I would really hope so then I have also find the weaknesses of the project, and the weakness, mm-hmm, is that because we have gathered information for very little time, this cannot be extrapolated yet to, mm, you know, like to run or to use this type of like animals and this type of samples to monitor the environment and even monitor the species. You need to have a very consecutive kind of sampling. And I think with 3 years, you cannot really say much. I would love to say like, oh yeah, you know, like we found whatever, like a box of information diamonds, but like, no, it's not the case. It's like a picture. And my hope for the future is that we could continue with this monitoring throughout the years, and I think you can have a more consistent understanding of the trends and what the different patterns mean. So now what I would really like is to work together with the community. So they have like it's a community of like 1,000 people, and then they're very engaged. They rely on their environment, so then they're very into listen to what scientific knowledge has to say on their own environment, but I would really like them to be the protagonists. So now we're talking with a few of the institutions to put on a grant that hopefully will be successful. So then we can kind of create a, would be like more like a little station. So then the people, especially people from the schools, for example, could participate for monitoring the species. So the good thing is that the pinnipeds are very visible. So if they change, something changes, it's something that can be grasped very quickly. So it's very obvious from 1 year to the other if there's like more or less numbers in the populations. And it would be really cool if they can also get engaged. So then they could also have their own kind of track, because I go once per year only.
Yeah.
And the real people that would know more, they're like the real experts are them, because then they are the ones that see them all the time. So it would be really cool to take this further, and they also can get their own science, which would be really cool.
It sounds like it would be a really interesting project, especially like you said, for people in schools and stuff to get engaged with and learn about, you know, not just like the biology that you would learn in the textbook, but actually realize like how close sometimes, like, you know, research can be, that you're just picking up seal feces and then, you know, someone's going to go and do all the analysis, and it's thanks to you that now there's this whole body of knowledge right outside your door. That's actually fascinating. And so you said you go once per year and then you return, I guess, to Cambridge and do your analysis here. What is it like kind of going between kind of being field work and then coming to lab work and balancing those together? And
Well, I feel quite fortunate because it's the southern hemisphere, and then I go when it's the reproductive season, which is when the first seals come to land. So then you can collect the feces from the land rather than having to hunt for them floating in the sea. But so that means that I escape from the winter.
So do you usually have to go diving to find the feces?
No, I collect them directly from the shore. Okay. So then the first ones will have like a mainly marine life. And then when it comes to reproduction, they all come to shore. The females will give birth. And then like a couple of days after, they will get pregnant again and start the new system. So that's when I take those times, because it's when the individuals will come into to land. So I think I kind of really like the mixed the balance between going to field work. It's also where I am from. So, well, I'm not from the island, but I'm from Chile. So it's kind of go back a little bit, refresh with all these. Well, going to field work has like lots of logistics things that you need to solve. And I was very lucky to have all the support of the local people, which also makes me feel I feel very lucky, because working there is very complicated from the point of view, like, you think you will go there, you will walk through the shore and then collect the fees is very easy, right? But then to get to the different points, you need to get there by boat. And then also to get to the island, you need a plane that is like very tiny, and it can only fly when there is like perfect weather. And if the ocean is bad, you cannot fly, because then the airport is in the other side of the island, which you need a boat to go to the mainland. So if the boat cannot get there, then the flight cannot get in. And then you rely on like ocean weather or ocean conditions, weather. If there's too wind, you cannot go out with the boat, and so on, so on. So it's like the first time I went, I was only able to collect samples for 3 days from the wow. month and a half that I was there. So it's like it builds lots of resilience, and you know, you go with like a very very low expectations, and hopefully they will, you know, turn around to be very good. So I have learned a lot about that. And yeah, and then, you know, some of the samples will stay in Chile, and then some of the samples I will bring here. And I really enjoy the lab work. I think it's because I have this combination of both that I feel very kind of refreshed, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you said before that you used to, I mean, you're a vet as well. Like before you started your PhD, you finished your vet studies. So what made you, because you said you wanted to work with a group of animals such as the ones that you're working with. So what made you decide, like, you know, I went through vet school, I'm not a qualified vet, but I'm just going to go back to uni and do a PhD. What made you kind of want to pursue that?
So again, I wish I could give you like a more like, academic kind of explanation. But again, it's another circumstantial thing. So I always knew that I wanted to work with wildlife. I was always, since I was a kid, I was always fulfilled with this like wildlife interest. However, I was very immature and I didn't really know. So I finished school and I thought that the only way I could do this was by, going to the vet school. I never really dreamed to be like a clinician or anything. I wanted to go to the vet school so I could work with wildlife. Like I didn't even thought in biology, for example, or zoology is not a thing in Chile. You cannot study zoology. So to me it was like the vet degree, and I did like different volunteering in different places with marine mammals or with marine animals, or with like, I went to the Amazon at some point, but then my sister got married in Berlin in Hamburg, and then that year I sent lots of email to various different people. So then I was like, oh well, you know, I'm going to Europe, I don't know where I'm going to be able to go back to Europe, so I would try to do like a little, you know, academic experience. And then I did send emails to everyone. I'm a veterinarian, I would like to get more experience in lab work and blah blah blah. And then Barbara Blacklow, my actual supervisor, she replied to the email, and then she took me, it's like, oh well, yeah, I have space. So I went, I did an internship with her, and then I went back to Chile, and then we were like, okay, so what do you want to do? And then she brought up the PhD, she kind of like make me feel that the PhD was an opportunity, because, you know, like I never really ever thought to even like Cambridge would be a possibility ever. And I thought that was like a very kind of place for gifted people, but actually there's like lots of opportunity once you go there and ask. So, cause then I was not like, or what I perceived that it would be like a Cambridge prototype of student. I was like very far away from that. I was more like amateur. but that's how I ended up here. So then I applied. I didn't get the scholarship at the first year. So I stayed here, worked as in one of the colleges as a caterer. And then the next year I got the scholarship, so then I stayed. So as you can see, it's nothing like, everything's very kind of opportunistic. road, I guess.
But it sounds like it's not just opportunity. I mean, you've consistently tried to make those opportunities happen, and it sounds like it's gone really well.
Yeah, it sounds like it's been sort of a really cool adventure as well, sort of really curating what you want to do for your PhD as well, and like what you'd like to do after, which is really cool. And like, I guess in a way it's quite an interesting PhD as well, because you're working with so many skill sets, because you're not just working in the lab, you're actually having to like communicate with a lot of different people, like many of whom aren't scientifically trained, so that's a lot of like public communication, and definitely very interdisciplinary with regards to like all of these branched out mm-hmm. projects. So I think it sounds like really, really cool. And like, yeah, I just wondered whether you were gonna just continue and hopefully get that proposal and put that through, and sort of following your PhD, will you be following that, or do you have anything else that you'd like to try, or what are your thoughts for the future?
If I'm very open, so I'm very realistic in the sense that in the perfect world, if I could like get whatever I want, then I would definitely love to continue with this project, because I think it's useful for the community as well. I truly mm-hmm. believe that this would be very useful if it is carry on like with continuity. However, considering like the world is very rough, I'm quite open to other experiences as well. I'm very open-minded. I have to say I'm not really stressed. I'm like kind of like go with the flow type of person. So if it works, then that's great, and if it not, I'm happy to welcome whatever comes after, which I don't know what's going to be.
It's good to be flexible though, like, yeah.
I mean, I guess that's how you ended up with this amazing project, right? Because you just followed the paths that opened up. Yeah. So I'm sure whatever would be great.
Yeah, definitely. I hope so too. Cool. Well, I think that might be all we have time for. So thank you so much for chatting to us. I've learned like loads about your project. And yeah, it's just been really fascinating to see how sort of conservation work and molecular work and, you know, loads of different types of science can kind of all come together. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's like always fun to talk to people.
Definitely.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did, why not leave a rating, maybe 5 stars? And you can also leave a review. This kind of thing really helps us know what you all think, but it also shows us your support. And as always, feel free to message us on Twitter, via email. Our email is podcast@blueside.co.uk. And hope you all stay safe and stay at home.